This is a Dharmanet presentation.
Okay, so for this evening's Dharma talk, we already were talking a little bit about some historical questions. So I thought maybe we could kind of continue them, but also kind of look at the role of history in Buddhism and why Buddhists are concerned with their history and what it means. So history is an interesting topic because obviously in Buddhism, Buddhism, at least in theory, is all about the present, right? So you should always be in the present moment and all letting go of the past and so on. But Buddhists are constantly concerned about the past, aren't we? Yeah. Ancient monuments and legends and the Buddha, he lived a long time ago. Why don't we just forget about it? Right? Because the Buddha's not today. Yeah, surely there are people alive today who are much more intelligent and articulate and advanced and evolved than the Buddha. But so as Buddhists, we always talk about being in the present, but we spend a lot of time being in the past. And I mean, I'm certainly no exception to that. I find history a fascinating topic, and to study the evolution of the Dhamma and its place in history and so on, I find to be very interesting. One of the reasons why history is interesting, especially for me, is because it helps us to give us some kind of sense of context of the time and place where the Buddha lived. Because otherwise the Buddha's teachings can be a little bit abstract. Right? So if we know who was it that the Buddha was speaking to, what kind of people were they, what were their concerns, what were their fears, what were their desires, what were they conditioned by, what were they aspiring for? And then we have some more idea of what the Buddha was talking about, why he taught in those particular ways, why he used particular language, why he used particular concepts, and why he didn't use other kinds of language and concepts that we might find more familiar. So I might talk a little bit about the history of Buddha and, you know, the times that he lived in, and what we know about that, what we don't know, and how that affects our understanding of the Dhamma. So one of the things that is important when we look at history is how do we know? I mean, if I asked anybody here what was the first thing that I said in this Dhamma talk, okay, we're already thinking, hang on, how do we start? Right, it's only a couple of minutes ago. So how can we talk reliably about things that happened 2,500 years ago? Right. So this is something that's not at all obvious, and it's very, you know, among scholars of all kinds of history, and including Buddhist history, there's a lot of discussion and disagreement about these particular points. Now, if we look in the Buddha's teachings, both in the early Buddhist teachings and also in the Buddhist traditions, we find that they always talk about two aspects of knowing, or two things that are helpful for being able to know something, okay? The first thing is direct experience, okay? The second one is inference. Two things, direct experience and inference. The other thing that's important about the Buddhist attitude to knowing, or to how do we know things, is that knowledge in Buddhism is always pragmatic, okay? That is to say that Buddhism is not a search for some kind of ultimate or absolute truth. The search for Buddhism is a search for the ending of suffering. Okay? So it doesn't really matter what kind of truth it is, as long as you can let go of suffering. That's all that matters. Right? So it's a functional theory of truth, or approach to truth. So we take bear these principles in mind when we begin to look at Buddhist history. So we bear in two things, the direct experience and the inference. And we do this, we use this for a pragmatic purpose. A pragmatic purpose is not so that we can get some final, absolute, definitive answers to who was the Buddha, you know, what did he teach, all of these questions, right? Because, of course, the Buddha was different to different people, right? I mean, even for you and I, we're different to different people. We mean different things to different people. And of course, the Buddha was like that. There's no final definitive answer to that. And there's no final definitive answer to the question, you know, what did the Buddha teach? Obviously, he taught different things at different times to different people. So there'll always be a room for a subjective and interpretive approach to those things. The important thing is what is useful, what is helpful to overcome suffering. Okay. Now, remember these two aspects of truth, the direct evidence and the inference. Now, in terms of direct evidence in the time of the Buddha, we look to things like, say, archaeology. Right? Even archaeology is not that direct, but it's reasonably direct evidence. And what does the archaeology tell us about the times of the Buddha? Okay. The answer to that is unfortunately not very much. Okay. But the best archaeology we have, the most useful and meaningful and certain facts that we have are the edicts of King Ashoka. Okay. You have these all across India, you have these big pillars and inscriptions in rock that record in a very archaic and primitive form of Indian writing, the most primitive form of Indian writing that we have, in fact, the extensive edicts of King Ashoka right across the whole of India. And so you have quite an extensive corpus because it's either carved in rocks which are in place, in situ, or else in massive pillars which are very hard to move. Then we're pretty sure that this is where these things belong, right? You can't pick it up and put it somewhere else. Eh? And because of the writing style and references to Greek and even Egyptian rulers and things at that time, we're able to fix King Ashoka fairly precisely in historical time, around 250 BC. So roughly 150 to 200 years after the Buddha, most probably. So the edicts of King Ashoka don't tell us all that much about the Buddha and his life, but they do tell us some things. Probably the most clear fact that we get from the Ashokan pillars is the pillar in Lumbini, which says that this is where the Buddha was born. Okay, so you have a big stone pillar created about 200 years or so after the Buddha, and it says literally says this is where the Buddha was born. Iha Buddha Jate. Twice it says that. So it doesn't get any better than that, right? That's, in terms of historical evidence, that's the gold standard, yeah? And so last year I had somebody ring me up in Bodhnyana, said he wanted to talk to me, he had this urgent historical finding. He said he discovered that the Buddha wasn't really born in Lumbini, he was born somewhere else. You know, from time to time you find people with these kinds of theories. And he was so enthusiastic, and I'm afraid I kind of disappointed him a lot. I just sort of cut him off and said, look, it's impossible, okay? The evidence that the Buddha was born in Lumbini is the best possible kind of historical evidence. There simply doesn't exist anything which is better than that. And so to argue based on anything, on any texts or any archaeological finds or anything you like, that the Buddha was born somewhere else, is just doomed from the beginning. Because there simply isn't any better evidence. Sometimes you just have to take a stand on these things. Otherwise, you know, when it comes to things like the life of the Buddha and so on, it becomes very speculative, and everyone likes to read their own things in there. So it's much better to keep some kind of grounding with what is the actual history. So that brings us to, you know, we've got a place, we've got a time, not long after the Buddha. What about in the time of the Buddha himself? Well, we don't have any really solid evidence for the life of the Buddha in terms of the archaeology. It seems that in the time of the Buddha that was just a beginning phases of urbanization in India. So there weren't like any really developed cities. Buildings were made of wood, so things were largely perishable. You know, there were the first cities were being built and so on, but they're still fairly small. Not long afterwards, in the time of Ashoka, in the time of the Nanda Empire, and then later the Mauryan Empire, of course, Pataliputra became a vast capital. And, you know, even from the Greek writings of Megasthenes, gives some idea of this as a huge metropolis by that time. And that's only 100 years after the Buddha. And so the India changed drastically. The cultural scene in India was undergoing a complete and radical revolution from the time of the Buddha until the time of the Nandas, really, about 50 years afterwards. All of the nations, the countries that the Buddha walked through, he gave a list in the suttas of the 16 great nations. And, you know, they're called 16 Mahajanapadas, which gives you a sense. At the time, they thought this was a great nation. You know, in fact, it's about the size of half of a state in current India, right? But for them, that was a great nation. And the kings were great kings, and the capitals were great capitals. But they haven't even left a single trace, or almost not a single trace, in the archaeological record. Within 50 years after the Buddha died, that scene had completely changed. The whole of India, from northwest of Delhi on the western side through to Kalinga on the southeast coast, was unified under the Nanda Empire. And we know this again, we have very strong evidence that this was the case. Huh? Because we have in Kalinga, we have an inscription that refers back to the rule of the Nandas and said that they built irrigation there. Right? So not only did they conquer it, but they actually did capital works there. So we know that. At the same time, when Alexander invaded India from the northwest, he came through Pakistan, and they very famously heard the rumors of the army of the Nanda emperors. And Alexander's army rebelled against him and wouldn't cross the river, wouldn't go into India, even just having heard about their herds of war elephants and other things. So this is a vast empire. Within just a few decades of the Buddha passing away, this had happened. Yeah, so it's very, very interesting, this very rapid shift. So from that period onwards, we have that, you know, strong concrete evidence of cities and capital works and things like that, inscriptions. But from the time of the Buddha, we have very little. The main evidence from the time of the Buddha is something which is very simple and very humble, and that's a kind of pottery they call Northern Black Polished Ware, NBPW, they usually abbreviate it. And it's a distinctive kind of pottery, like they can identify in the archaeological strata. Earlier there was another one they call Painted Grey Ware, and then they developed this black, Northern Black Polished Ware. What that signifies is it was more control of fire. Yeah? You think about that, yeah? It's not just pottery. It means that they could fire kilns to a much higher degree. Yeah? At the same time, iron was developed in India, right? So both of those requiring a lot of heat, a lot of energy, and so both of them signifying this advance in the technology of the use of fire. And that happened around the time of the Buddha, maybe a little bit earlier. And through that whole area, the main thing that you find characteristic, you find iron smelters, the remnants of them, but you find the fragments of pottery, the Northern Black Polished Ware, and you find that all the way around in the areas of the Buddha, of India, where the Buddha was said to travel in the suttas. So all the area around Rajagaha, modern-day Bihar, to Sarvati, Vaisali, and so on, all the areas that we hear the Buddha traveling around again and again in the suttas. So that whole area is characterized by the Northern Black Polished Ware. And I was talking about this with some of the monks last year, and we were saying, how come this Northern Black Polished Ware is what we find from the culture at the time, but we don't find any mention of it in the suttas, right? We look up in the suttas for Northern Black Polished Ware, and we're trying to think, where is it? And we couldn't find any references to it. So that's strange. And then all of a sudden one day I realized, hang on, you eat out of it every day. That's what the monk's bowls is Northern Black Polished Ware, actually. In the Vinaya it says there are two materials which you can make your bowls out of, right? One of them is iron, and the other is pottery. Clay, yeah? And that's precisely those two materials whose technology is characteristic of that period, yeah? Iron and the Northern Black Polished Ware. In fact, I was told later that there actually is a remnant of an ancient Buddhist monk's bowl in a museum in India. I've never seen it, but it is in fact out of Northern Black Polished Ware. So that's what, when you see the black shiny color of the monk's bowls, that's where that comes from. This is the Northern Black Polished Ware. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, we've been using it for such a long time. So this was that culture of that period and that time and that place. So So we're getting this kind of feeling for a culture which is in a rapid period of change. Yeah. One of the, I guess, one of the myths or one of the stories that we often tend to believe about the past is that the past was static. Yeah? We tend to project into the past that everything was always the same. And obviously, you know, our current times is changing much more rapidly, right? So we find much more rapid change today in the past, fair enough. But still, things weren't the same all the time. And in particular, when it comes to ancient India, we often sort of have this idea in the back of our minds that ancient India was Hindu, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Were Indians Hindus?
Yeah.
No? Deepika knows better because she's heard me give Dhamma talks. Right? So we have this idea that Hinduism's always been there, right? And the Buddha was a Hindu, right? Is that right? That's what many people think. But things are always changing. That's actually not true at all. To say that the Buddha was Hindu, or that Indians even were Hindu in the time of the Buddha, is completely anachronistic. And in fact, it's like saying that Moses was a Catholic. Right? Yeah? Moses a Catholic? No. Moses belonged to a religious tradition, right? Which evolved and changed and transformed and became Catholicism, and which is a part of that thing. So, yes, obviously there are religious traditions which are part of what we call Hinduism, right? They're not disconnected. But what we understand of as Hinduism today didn't even remotely exist in the time of the Buddha. Yeah? If you look at specific examples of things, like, for example, if you know, say the worship in temples, right? There was no temples. Yeah? Worship of Krishna, not heard of. Shiva, not heard of. Vishnu, not heard of. Ganesh, not heard of. Rama, not heard of. And so on. So all of these major gods in Hinduism are either completely unknown, or else maybe they're mentioned as minor deities once or twice here and there, but they're certainly not kind of the dominant, you know, focus of worship that they are today in contemporary Hinduism. What you did have in the time of the Buddha, you had the Vedas, which had their different religious teachings. You had the Vedic rituals based on those. You had the Brahmins, who were the bearers of the Vedas, and so on. So that's obviously an important strand of the tradition which became Hinduism. You also find various sort of local worship cults. This is very, very common, like yakas and nagas and so on. Each village and each town, they would worship their local yakas and their local nagas and things like that. Now today, if we were to go to India, we think of that as part of Hinduism, right? In fact, it's completely different. Right? There's no historical relationship between those things whatsoever, right? The Vedic religion was something which was brought to India by the Aryan peoples. Right? When they came there, they found people who were already worshipping these yakas and nagas and so on. They're actually quite different religious strands. Right? And so one of the accomplishments of the great Hindu scholars of the Middle Ages, Shankara and others, was to unify all of those different religious traditions, so that all of those local strands, the different philosophical traditions, the contemplative traditions, the Vedic ritual traditions, and so on, all of those different strands, which actually were quite separate, and they weren't seen as being part of the same thing, they were all brought within one umbrella. Yeah? And that synthesis happened around 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries, that's 1,000 years after the Buddha. And it's that synthesis which we call Hinduism. Right? And that synthesis didn't exist in the time of the Buddha, even though many of the elements, not all of the elements, but many of those elements did exist. Yeah? But they were quite separate things. So if you hear somebody saying that, you know, the Buddha was a Hindu, then you know, this is just anachronistic. It's obviously, in one sense, you know, the Buddha's family would have been, you know, practicing the local religious rites, we assume, right? We assume that in Kapilavastu, like anywhere else, they probably had their local spirits who they'd do maybe ceremonies for the harvest and so on and so forth. And we assume that his family and that young Siddhartha participated in those things and so on. But this is more to do with just a kind of the relationship with the spirits and the relationship with nature and so on and so forth. It's not really to do with being a Hindu in that kind of sense. So this actually is one of the things which was already discovered and made very clear in the late 19th century. Actually, when in the modern era, when we first started to trace back the history of Buddhism, the first people that the history of Buddhism was learnt from, or history of India was learnt from, was from the Brahmin pandits. When the British were in India, they studied the Hindu Puranas and the Brahmin pandits, and that's the Brahmin pandits said, India has always been Hindu. And this kind of idea got into the mainstream, and it's been very persistent ever since then. But it didn't take long until people like Thomas Rhys Davids and others who read the Pali texts, they read the things like the Mahavamsa and so on, they began to do the archaeology. Cunningham discovered all the ancient Buddhist sites. They began to realize, hang on, if this is if India has always been a Hindu country, how come for hundreds of years in the archaeological record, nearly a millennium, in fact, in the archaeological record, we find nothing of Hinduism and plenty of things of Buddhism and Jainism? Okay? It's also something just to bear in mind. At the time of Ashoka, all of the hundreds of years, there's nothing of Hinduism. Gradually, they start to appear, but still the majority of archaeological findings in India, for maybe, probably, I guess, 1,000 years after the Buddha, the majority of things are all Buddhist. Yeah? And gradually, Buddhism started to decline and the Hinduism started to get more popular. So India, like anywhere else, was shifting and changing. So there are different strands and so on. So when we're looking at the Buddha and trying to understand his teachings, then of course it's very important to understand who is he teaching for. Now this is not something which is purely an abstract idea. Right? For example, this has real implications in terms of how people understand Buddhism. And just as one example of that is a common argument which you'll hear is that the Buddha taught rebirth, right? Because that's what everyone believed. Yeah, everyone believed in rebirth, right? So the Buddha just adopted this Hindu idea and taught this Hindu idea of rebirth. Right? This is what some people will argue. Now, if you know the historical situation, you know that, well, that's a bit silly, right? It wasn't Hindu for a start. In fact, the culture at the time of the Buddha was extremely diverse. And this is one of the things that we learn from looking at the early suttas. Huh? There's so much diversity, both within the Brahmanical tradition and also outside of the Brahmanical tradition. I mean, the Brahmanical tradition, which evolved into what we call Hinduism, was very, very far from being some kind of unified, rigid, dogmatic system, right? I mean, Hinduism has never been like that. It was very questioning. There were all kinds of different takes on things, all kinds of different interpretations, and all kinds of different ways of relating, even within the Brahmanical tradition. And we find this questioning spirit, both within the Buddhist texts, we also find it within the Brahmanical scriptures at the same time, within the Upanishads, same kind of thing. People asking, questioning what their tradition was, what the meaning of these rituals were, what the role of these scriptures were, what's the role of experience. Not only was that questioning going on within the Brahmanical tradition, it was also going on in the other non-Brahmanical traditions, what we call the Shramana traditions in ancient India. And the Buddha, of course, counted himself among the Shramana traditions. And the defining point of that being that they didn't hold allegiance to the Vedic tradition and the Brahmanical tradition, but the Shramana traditions based themselves on the experience of direct vision of the truth. So within the Shramana movement, of course, again, a lot of diversity in the time of the Buddha, but of those movements, only Buddhism and Jainism have lasted to the present day. All of the other Shramana movements have passed away, although some of them lasted for a long time in India. There's evidence of the Ajivika tradition for, I think, about 1,500 years or so in India. So they weren't minor movements by any means. So the Buddha positioning himself as a Shramana movement that is positioning himself outside of the Vedic and Brahmanical mainstream, as an iconoclast, right? He rejecting the rituals, rejecting the authority of the Vedas, and proposing a radical new way of seeing the truth and a way of living. So, like I said, we can't situate the Buddha too firmly in time through the archaeological record, right? We only have those few scraps of things from the northern black polished ware and a few other bits and pieces from the time of the Buddha, but nothing really substantial. One of the interesting pieces of archaeology which has just come to light in recent years is the finds at a place called Deokota. And this is, Deokota is a almost unknown site in ancient India, which was discovered in 1984 by some archaeologists, right? And they discovered it purely randomly. They said, well, look, there's some Buddhist sites over here, and there's some Buddhist sites over there, and it seems that the Buddhists were travelling along from there to there, so there's probably something in between them. So they went there and had a look around and asked the villagers, are there any ancient sites there? And they said, oh, yeah, there's one over there. So they went and saw, and it's actually quite a major site. So lots of stupas, dozens of rock-cut caves, paintings, and inscriptions, yeah? So it gives you an indication of how many things are still undiscovered. But one of the things which they found at the site of Deokota is the oldest lineage list. It's actually very interesting. It's a rock inscription in Brahmi characters from about the time of Ashoka, maybe a little bit later. It seems that the Deokota site may be somewhat pre-Ashokan, but the inscription is maybe a little bit later than that. But the inscription traces back a lineage of teachers. There are two inscriptions. They both trace back a lineage of teachers back to the Buddha himself through about 9 or 12 generations of teachers. There's a bit of uncertainty because the inscriptions aren't preserved 100%, but as far as we can tell, there's about 9 or 12 steps in the lineage of teachers back to the Buddha. Right? So that's not all that much, is it? Yeah? So if you estimate maybe 20 years, for each generation of teacher and student, something like that. So roughly about 200 years or so between this inscription and the time of the Buddha. Deokota is in the old area, even though it's not a site that's known from the early suttas, but it's still within that same area as in the early Buddhist area. It's not far from Bodh Gaya, to the west, and maybe a little bit south. I think maybe 100 or 200 kilometers. Compared to Rajagaha and Bodh Gaya. So there is, there's not much evidence, but what there is does definitely point back to the idea of the Buddha as an actual person, as a living historical memory in that time and that place. Yeah? So these, as I mentioned at the beginning, the things that we can know directly, right? So there's a few bits and pieces that we know directly, and from there we have to rely on inference, right? So fortunately we have the suttas and the Vinaya, and even though, we can't prove that those things all come from the time of the Buddha, but what's very obvious is that the picture of the time and the place that they paint is very much the same as what the archaeological record is showing. That is the same, the culture which covered that same area. We have a similar level of the language and the depiction of the culture and so on and so forth. And so it's very much sort of based in that time and that place in that period and couldn't really take place in any other time in Indian history. Yeah? Again, remembering that things change. So, to think about our own culture, right? If you were to read somebody writing a story, and they might write a story about somebody who went for a holiday and was walking down the beach or something like that, and then they used their iPhone to tweet a message, right? Now, immediately you would know within a few years when that story was set, okay? And if somebody said, and this story was set in the 1950s, you'd say, hang on, right? No, it's a genuine story, but maybe they had iPhones in those days, but we just didn't know about it, right? Right? And you think, well, of course, it's ridiculous, right? It's the same if you know the history, then hang on, you know, there's a certain sequence to the development of these technologies, right? And there's a certain you can see the gradual growth and the urbanization, the development of culture, the evolution of the rules of governance and kingship, the expansion of the kingdoms, the expansion of the trade routes, the knowledge of lands outside of that area, and so on. And so this is one of the reasons why Venerable Brahmali and myself have written a book in the last year about the authenticity of the Buddhist scriptures. And one of the main arguments that we've used and we've developed is that the suttas, you know, you have millions of words in the suttas and the Vinaya, which is located in that time and that place, right? And nowhere does it mention iPhones, okay? Right? Not to mention iPhones, nowhere does it mention, say, things like writing. Okay, so even there's one or two mentions of writing in the Pali Canon, which are probably in some of the later portions of it. You know, there's no mention of, for example, a kingship or a country which extended across the whole of India. Okay, and this is something which actually was the political reality in India a few decades after the Buddha died. And yet the political situation in the time of the Buddha is always represented as these multiple different countries, these small little kingships. Yeah. Sorry? Like councils, like kind of local states, local kingships. Yeah, yeah. It's almost like a more feudal kind of environment. Yeah. And you can see the scale of things that's imagined in the time of the Buddha. For example, there's a sutta on the Cartwright. Okay, and where the king is felt to have gone there was going to be a war or something like that, so the king needed a new chariot, right? So he went to the Cartwright to say, "Build me a new chariot," right? So he's giving a sense of the scale of things, right? You know, you can imagine the Prime Minister of Australia thinking, "Oh, we're going to have a war soon. We'd better get a tank. I've got to go down to the local mechanics and get them to make me a tank," right? You know, you can see things are being imagined on a very small scale. King Ashoka didn't do that, right? King Ashoka had a city with a million people in it and armies with thousands of elephants and stuff like that. So you can imagine a situation where a king would personally go to the chariot to the carpenter to prepare his chariot for the war. Yeah? So everything's happening at a very small scale. Anyway. So when we look at that history, we get more of a sense for who the Buddha was, what he was teaching in that time and that place, yeah. And to come back to that teaching on rebirth that I mentioned before, and that being one of the major issues that people bring up again and again. You know, you can see that the within the Brahmanical tradition, okay, there was no sort of fixed or very solid idea about rebirth at that time. Okay, the Vedas don't give anything particularly clear about rebirth. The Upanishads give a lot of different accounts, several different accounts about what happens when you die and what happens to the Atman after death and these kinds of things. Right? There's no like fixed, clear view about what rebirth is, as you find in later Hinduism. Similarly, within the Shramana traditions, certain of them accepted the idea of rebirth, like Jainism, for example. Others rejected it and said, no, when you die, your body just goes back to the four elements and nothing exists after death. So it was quite possible for people to teach these things. And the ideas were current in the culture. The Buddha knew about them. It talked about quite clearly and explicitly and openly in the suttas. So the idea that the Buddha was somehow forced to teach about rebirth because that's what his cultural expectations were and he couldn't teach anything else is completely absurd. You and I are quite capable of understanding what our culture teaches, reflecting on it, and deciding for ourselves whether we agree with it, right? Not to speak of you and I, any 15-year-old school child is capable of doing that, right? And any of you who've got children will know that that's the case, right? That sometimes your children will agree with things that you tell them or what your culture tells them, and sometimes they'll disagree. And so to say that the Buddha was unable to do that is to say that the Buddha had less intelligence and reflective capacity than a 15-year-old school child. Yeah? But this is what people say. Anyway, so the Buddha taught about rebirth because that was what his experience was, that was what his understanding was, that was what the reality that he perceived. So that was what he based that teaching on. So this is just one example, but it's an example of how we can see by studying and by understanding a little bit better the history, the time, the place, the culture that the Buddha lived in, that we can put the Buddha's teachings in a context that has meaning within that culture. And then once we've done that, we can then start to ask those questions about, well, how does that apply for us now? How, what does that mean for our culture? How should we present the Dhamma here? How should we practice the Dhamma in our own lives? Because just as the Buddha, everything the Buddha said always begins with a time and place, right? Every sutta. Yeah? One time, the Buddha was staying in Savatthi. Yeah? There's a time and there's a place. Everything has a time and place. It has a historical context. And that's every time you sit and meditate, at a time and a place. Every time your mind becomes overwhelmed with anger, it becomes overwhelmed with anger at a time and a place. And there are certain reasons for that. There's conditions, there's a culture, there's a context, there's a background. And so we can only understand these things when we begin to understand the background. Okay, so that's probably talking for enough this evening. So I offer that for your reflection, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions.